This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Okay, welcome to the next session. This is Infants on Thrones panel, navigating a world full of echo chambers.
Echo chambers.
With Matt Long, Glenn Oslin, and Scott Rowley. How many of you are Infants listeners? I want to hear applause.
Woo! You don't listen.
All right. For some reference, Matt Long, right here, this gentleman in the middle, is a criminal defense attorney in Mesa, Arizona, previously working for 12 years as a deputy county attorney, where he primarily prosecuted sex crimes, child crimes, and homicide cases. He continues to present at child crimes conferences throughout the country. To be fair, I think I used his bio that he did on a criminal session at Sunstone, so that was a little dark for this panel. Glenn Oslin, right over here, studied Mormon folklore at Indiana University and came half a dissertation away from finishing a PhD on Mormon humor, but he never really did anything with that because really, what can you do with a PhD in folklore?
I need to update.
I'm updating my bio for summer. I've got something much better.
That's super offensive to all the folklorists in the room. I don't.
So what happens when they don't answer my emails? Scott Rowley is a family attorney from Mesa, Arizona. He is among the principal founders of Any Opposed and Infants on Thrones, and the principal founder of the Mormon Genome Project. Accurate?
Yeah, true.
You're welcome.
And now the founder of the Trump dossier review. Add that to the list.
All right. So, echo chambers.
Echo chambers.
Okay, who's going first?
Do you have your PowerPoint? You want to just go?
You go, Glenn.
Okay. You get set up.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk today about echo chambers. And that when Lindsay asked us to be involved with this, we knew that, you know, Infants on Thrones, there's 9 people. We're not all here. The 3 of us are here in the area. So we thought, what can we talk about, and how are we going to do it? And I think Scott, Matt, and I, especially this last election cycle, were really aware of echo chambers or these bubbles that people live in or seem to live in. I think there's been a lot of conversation about the way that the news media is these days. There's so many different options that people gravitate towards whatever source of news most conforms with their already established belief system, and it's a comfortable place for them. And so we talk about this as being in bubbles or being in echo chambers where any kind of challenge to whatever the status quo is or the assumed, the basic assumptions is met with some resistance. We saw that a lot with the election. And we've seen that, you know, for those of you who don't know Infants on Thrones, we're a podcast, former Mormons, and we've been doing it for about 5 years now. We've got over 350 episodes that are up. And like I said, it's a group of 9 of us. We just get together and we talk, we have fun with each other, and we publish the conversations and people listen to them. But every once in a while we get feedback from people that call us an echo chamber or something.
Usually when they disagree with us.
Yeah. So we thought that's interesting. Let's talk about that. And so each one of us have written maybe a 10-15 minute presentation on echo chambers and what echo chambers mean to us, and that's what we're going to do today in presenting that to you. And then there will be some time for questions at the end, I think. So I'm going to read mine. So, and I think it's interesting to me, what does it mean when somebody calls Infants on Thrones an echo chamber? And I'm going to focus a lot on the podcast, but I think that the discussion can be extrapolated to other groups. It's not just about Infants on Thrones as a podcast, but anytime you have an echo chamber. But I do want to start off with some comments that people have left either on our website, responding to specific episodes, or up on iTunes or other places where they're rating the podcast in general. So this first one was left August 10th, 2016, by someone named Mike Klob, who gave us 2 out of 5 stars on iTunes. And so Mike Klob says, You hate for one bad experience to destroy your whole perception of something. However, after listening to Infants for Hillary, I can never listen to infants again. This is exactly how I felt after watching Jar Jar Binks. It may be unfair to judge George Lucas by Jar Jar, but after I watched Jar Jar, I could never waste time ever listening to anything produced by George Lucas ever again. I lost respect for him, just like I lost respect for the infants. After listening to all the straw man arguments, oversimplification, mischaracterization, oversimplification, and
that's not a three pattern.
And demonization. Yeah, he threw in the same one twice to avoid the three pattern. And demonization in this episode, I can never take anything any of them say seriously again, ever. That is the worst echo chamber, ding, 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 I've ever heard. Okay, so that's where the echo chamber part comes in on that. And I just want to make sure everybody knows that the Infants for Hillary episode was Bob, John, Jake, and Randy there. So I, another comment from November 15th on our website, someone named Ryan said, "You know why your SmackDowns and panel discussions are usually better than others? You are allowed to argue with each other and call each other out. Not only does this encourage more humor and entertaining discussion, but it also helps minimize the echo chamber effect, at least by a bit." So a little bit, you know, so we're still in echo chamber, but you know, maybe not as much as others. I'm not quite sure what that really means. But then the final one I'll share is from October 18th, 2015. This was on the website from someone named Ward. In response to another episode, "One of the worst episodes ever. What a gush session for Community of Christ and John Hamer. It is, after all..."
How dare they talk about people they have great respect for.
"It is, after all, another church. Hamer believes religious stuff, but not all the LDS crap, so you think he's so awesome and you're so thrilled to be with him. Any religious belief is crazy to me. Oh, I miss the days of John Larson. I know he would call BS on this CFC promotional episode and bromance you guys have with Hamer. I'm done with infants after this one. Have fun. Go join a new church." And then the response to that comment was, "Goodbye, Ward. You sure told us. Go find an echo chamber more your speed." And that was from our very own Randy Snyder in response there. So here are some examples of when people use echo chambers, invoking a response or a critique of what we do on the podcast. But what does it actually mean? So maybe I could do this in my general authority intonation. The Urban Dictionary tells us that an echo chamber is an insular communication space where everyone agrees with the information and no outside input is allowed. Now, Urban Dictionary also says that an echo chamber is the act of inserting an empty wrapping paper tube into two facing anuses and then concurrently breaking wind. But that is not the
That's
echo
not what
chamber
we're talking about.
We're not talking about
that. We're going definition one today.
I'm happy he made that distinction.
Yeah, I just don't want anybody
For those
to
of you who came specifically to learn about that, that it's not... Yeah, sorry, Bryce. You're
yeah. So what do you guys think when you hear echo chamber? Have you ever been accused of being a part of an echo chamber? You know, if so, how do you feel when that happens? What does it mean? Is an echo chamber a good thing or is it a bad thing? So what I think is that there's a lot of vigilant policing of social group boundaries that are going on here. So when listeners accuse us of being an echo chamber, what I think they usually mean, they mean it in a bad way. They mean it pejoratively as a way to try to shame us into getting back to whatever it is that they want us to be. There's things they agree with, we say something they don't agree with, and then boom. So I think it's a shaming device. They're basically telling us that we've scribbled outside the lines, we need to get back on track. And I think there's also some sense of betrayal that goes on in these cases where they feel like, what the heck? I thought we were on the same team, and now all of a sudden I find out, you know, you're a Judas. What's going on? So I think validation or invalidation is a key trigger in this. Now, if you listen to the podcast and have been listening for a while, you may know that I have the nickname the TBM Whisperer, which I wear quite proudly, and that this was something that Jake assigned to me several years ago because I have a tendency of, I hope, trying to represent another perspective than just we're bashing on Mormons.
And if you're looking for a personalized license plate,
it's no longer available.
It's taken.
Yeah.
Because that's what he has on his car now. It's TBM Whisperer.
Right.
Yeah.
Whisperer. Yeah. Yeah. Because I've always felt an aversion to echo chambers. I've always thought that's something that isn't the best way to have a dialogue if you're shutting down any ability to challenge the assumptions that people have. I think challenging those assumptions is important. And so I started off thinking, oh, echo chambers are bad. But I've kind of changed that a little bit, and that's what I want to explore. Mm-hmm. Because I'd never really stopped to ask, you know, echo chambers are everywhere. We know that they're everywhere. Why are they everywhere? People continue to interact with each other in echo chambers, and given the choice, they'd probably gravitate more towards an echo chamber than away from it. So there's got to be some value in doing that, or it wouldn't continue. So what is that value? If you've been listening to the podcast over the last few months, you've probably heard us talk from time to time about this book, The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. That has changed the way that I think about echo chambers and a lot of things. So in the third section of his book, Haidt talks about this idea of a hive switch, which essentially means that there's something in our brains that reward us and make us feel especially good anytime we validate or reinforce or defend our chosen social groups. Haidt claims that survival of the fittest isn't based only on the individual-to-individual competition throughout the existence of humanity, but it's also the way that groups compete against groups. And the tighter the group, the greater the chance of survival for that group, and the greater the chance of survival, the more our bodies have evolved to encourage behavior that increases those chances and to discourage behavior that doesn't. So I don't really have time to go into this in as much detail as I'd like to, but I'm going to read some excerpts from The Righteous Mind, and this is under a section called The Biology of the Hive Switch. So this is Jonathan Haidt here. He says, if the hive switch is real, then it must be made out of neurons, neurotransmitters, and hormones. If evolution chanced upon a way to bind people together into large groups, the most obvious glue is oxytocin, a hormone and neurotransmitter produced by the hypothalamus. He talks about some experiments that people did, and this is one of them. He says, if you squirt oxytocin spray into a person's nose, he or she will be more trusting, and he talked about different experiments that they did to test that. Conversely, people who behave trustingly cause oxytocin levels to increase in the partner that they've trusted. Oxytocin levels also rise when people watch videos about other people suffering, among those who report feelings of empathy and a desire to help. So if we could put oxytocin into the world's drinking water, might there be an end to war and cruelty? And he says, no, unfortunately not. Because that's not the way that we've evolved. If the hive switch is a product of group selection, then it would show the signature feature of group selection, which is parochial altruism. So think about in the church for a minute, your experience in the church, the Relief Society, home teachers, visiting teachers, other auxiliary organizations, they do a really amazing job of taking care of people in the ward. When they're sick or when they have any kind of serious problem in their lives, they band together and they help each other out. But they don't typically do this for non-ward members or people outside of their immediate, closely knit social group. So this is an example of this parochial altruism. And I've heard ex-Mormons be very critical at times that Mormons do this, but according to what Haidt is telling us in the book, this is a very normal part of human nature. So I'm going to continue with Haidt here. He says that oxytocin should bond us to our partners and our groups so that we can more effectively compete with other groups, but it should not bond us to humanity in general. Several recent studies have validated this prediction. In one set of studies, Dutch men played a variety of economic games. Half of the men had been given a nasal spray of oxytocin and half got a placebo spray. The men who received oxytocin made less selfish decisions. They cared more about helping their group, but they showed no concern at all for improving the outcomes of men in the other groups. And then this part's really interesting. In one of these studies, oxytocin actually made men more willing to hurt other teams because doing so was the best way to protect their own group. So oxytocin simply makes people love their in-group more. So there's a lot of really fascinating stuff here that we just don't have time to explore. But I did write down six questions that maybe at other times we could explore together. I don't know. Scott and Matt may address these in their presentations. But it's not just oxytocin. He also talks about mirror neurons in the brain that play the same type of function in creating a tight group, sense of tight group. So my first question, when listeners tune into an Infants on Thrones podcast and they hear us smack down something that they dislike about the church, are their brains creating oxytocin at that point? Is there a hormonal biological connection forming between the listeners of the podcast and us creating it as a spoof? Some things that maybe we need to think about. Second question.
That might explain the sense of betrayal that people feel
right
when they see something that they're not used to experiencing.
So the second question, when listeners laugh along with our silly dad joke style of philosophies of men mingled with humor, are mirror neurons firing in the brains and creating a sense? It's rephrasing that first question, really. Number three, Height mentions that having a shared morality and being a tight group, it both binds groups together but also blinds them to themselves and to others. So it binds and blinds. And it's not hard to identify the shared values that bind most of our listeners together if we're talking about the podcast. But what are the things that we're blind to when it comes to critiquing our own flaws? That's something that's interesting to me. Number four, what is the social cost? This is a huge one. What is the social cost of pointing out flaws in our group when we find them? Will the group turn on anyone who challenges the status quo? Are blind sheep followers happier or healthier than people that take the position that say, well, actually, the true position on this is, and then those are instigators. So what is the social cost between those tendencies? Five, what is the secret sauce, middle ground, if there is one, balance between playing to important in-group validation messages and in keeping it real? Is it possible to bind without becoming blind to the flaws of the group? And I just got one more. The irreverent mockery and satire that we do on Infants on Thrones is clearly an important part of the listening experience for our listeners. It helps them feel less alone in all the anger and the hurt that comes from a faith crisis, and in that way, it helps validate them in their position. But does that come at a cost? Does the irreverent mockery and satire encourage the blinding aspects of a shared morality? So are we creating an echo chamber of jerks? do the pros outweigh the cons? So I don't have any answers to these questions, but I hope that Infants on Thrones can continue to be a place that helps people who feel alone when they want to go through a faith crisis, that we can provide that. But I also hope that we can foster greater understanding and acceptance of those who see things very differently than we do, and that we're not simply creating this, obnoxious echo chamber. And so I say these things with my head cocked to the side like this. Amen.
That awesome, everybody. Yeah. Okay.
Can we go next?
That's fine. Okay. Or I can go. You can take it. Tell me.
Okay.
I'll be the concluding speaker.
You'll be the concluding speaker. Yes.
You have the highest priest.
I think you're a high priest, aren't you?
No. Oh. I was a low one.
A low priest?
Yeah.
Everybody loves PowerPoint, right?
That should have been one of the questions that you asked.
Oh, yeah, do you like PowerPoint? Right, yeah. Right. Okay, that's supposed to go away. There we go. All right. So I'm not going to talk about the podcast as much. I'm going to talk about echo chambers, things that I'm concerned about with echo chambers right now, especially having to do with Facebook, politics, our personal lives, and as people who have mostly found ourselves on the fringes of communities that we belong to or associate with people who are on the fringes, how does that affect our relationships? How do we deal with that with other people? So I found this slide or this picture, and it totally resonated with me because, and I'm going to talk about Facebook a little bit more, but I probably don't even need to ask because I know how many of you have already clicked that you're going to my pizza party tonight. I know you're all on Facebook. You're on Facebook every day. Most people spend, or a lot of people spend, a significant amount of time on Facebook. So I don't think it's zooming in too much to talk about how Facebook becomes a echo chamber within itself in the specifics. Okay, so I'm going to focus on that a little bit today. But this is a lot of times kind of how we find ourselves in our online experiences, where we're looking at something and then we're going deeper. At least this is my experience. We go deeper and deeper and deeper onto something, and sort of, you know, between messaging and articles that we're reading and seeing your news feed, it's like you're seeing all these different layers, but it's really a lot of the same picture of what you may end up seeing as you spend time, especially with a screen instead of face-to-face with a person. And so because of that, there's sort of this feedback loop that happens. And I'm not here to criticize an echo chamber necessarily. And I'll talk about this a little bit more towards the end. But like what Glenn, some of the points he was hitting on about this idea of being sort of isolated or in an echo chamber, it's good for us in a lot of ways. It feels safe. It feels comfortable. We're able to be with people that we feel safe around, and that we're not going to feel like we're constantly being challenged. Nobody wants to live outside of their echo chamber. Like, that wouldn't be a healthy, good thing to do. Professionally, I deal with people who are often going through the worst experiences of their life. I'm a family law attorney, so I do divorce, custody, adoption, severance, juvenile, termination, every unfortunate and difficult thing where families interact with the law. That's what I deal with every day. And so I see clients often come to me, and they have been living in one side of this experience, and they've got their perspective. And sometimes it's my job, well, it's always my job to advocate for them, but I also play the role of mediator in some of these situations. And then sometimes I also have to help my clients be able to see how someone else is gonna see their situation. Like, how is the judge gonna see this? How does your ex see this? How are your kids gonna perceive what you're going forward and thinking is so rational and reasonable? And I'm, especially as ex-Mormons, in the community that I'm mostly in with a lot of my friends, I've been shocked how easy it is for us to get into a zone where it's very hard to empathize. Like, it's hard for me to even remember Mormon terms, and I didn't stop attending until like 4 years ago. So I haven't even been out that long in terms of not attending, and I already feel like I'm so disjointed from this community that I grew up with, and it's hard to empathize and put myself back into that mindset sometimes. So those are just kind of some thoughts on some reflections on it. So back to Facebook, right? So Facebook has these algorithms, and algorithms are, I'm told, they have something to do with math. So I'm not going to try and explain what algorithms are, but basically Facebook designs itself to feed you more of what you want. It doesn't design itself to feed you things that you don't want to see. In fact, it gives you every opportunity to push those things that you don't want to see away. I want to block this person, hide this person. I don't want to see this. This is offensive to me. It feels like spam, right? There's all those answers for all those things that you can put on there. So when we're looking at Facebook all the time, sometimes it's just like, wow, everything here is good and great. And oh, I don't like that. Okay, that's gone. And we can't do that in our face-to-face interactions, right? It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way with family members. It certainly doesn't work that way with politics. So Facebook is sort of this artificial bubble that we're all in. I've once or twice, if you've seen my thread, I've once or twice been in a political conversation on Facebook.
I don't know why you do that, Scott.
Yeah, I really shouldn't.
Yeah.
Matt never does.
I never post political stuff.
Right. So this...
sarcastically. Sorry.
This is a bimodal distribution for graph nerds. So over here on the left, we've got echo chambers with lots of likes. So if you make a post and it's just like 400 likes, nobody's talking about it. okay, that's your echo chamber. I think like kittens and puppies are probably in that zone too. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be the ones where nobody's really liking your post as much, or you're not getting as many likes, but you're getting tons and tons of comments. And that's where things just go completely out of control a lot of times. And then there's this sort of elusive butter zone of actual thought and conversation that doesn't happen nearly enough. So let's talk for a minute about how maybe that middle zone can be expanded a little bit when we're having important conversations. And I'm not trying to say that we need to always be out of every one of our echo chambers, but we just went through this huge election cycle. There's a lot of things going on in politics right now. So I think it's important for us to at least make an effort to try and have a dialogue and have conversation with other people. This is live picture from the southern border right now. No, it's not actually. This is China.
China.
I got this picture here because it's such an example of how people can all be existing in the same space, but probably not experiencing what they want to be experiencing or what they're there for. Right? It looks really crowded and horrible, and like you're stuck up on this. It doesn't really look like they're experiencing the Great Wall. It's like they're there, but they're not. That's not really what's going on here. And the whole transgender bathroom conversation that's happening right now in public discourse is really not about bathrooms. It's not about it's not what it's about at all. It's about all these other things that we're not focusing on and not talking about, plus obligatory cat picture. So sometimes this is what our political discussions are feeling like, right? We're just this bimodal distribution. We're just in these two separate camps. And that doesn't mean that one's equally as much right as the other one, but it can feel that way. So I don't know if you can read all the words up here, but this chart, there's a lot of data here, but this is ideological echo chamber. So the percentages of people who say, and then on the left, it's more important to live in a place with people who share my political views. And then in the right column, this is people, the percentage of people who say, most of my close friends share my political views. Okay? So what you can notice with each of these is that the more ideologically distant you are from the middle, the more likely you are to say that it's important to you to separate yourself from people who disagree with you. Okay? So even if you're somebody who's really liberal or really whatever, that doesn't mean you're escaping this phenomenon. It means you're actually probably part of it. And there's a bit of a difference here. You can see for most of the conservative people, the people who say they're consistently conservative, 50% of them say it's important to live in a place where people share their political views. For people who are consistently liberal, that's lower. It's 35%. And then the same thing with close friends' political views. If you happen to be conservative, you're probably more likely to be in that zone than if you're consistently liberal, but still around 50% of the people. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's this guy's reading Echo Chamber Times. Map of the world is his cross streets, right where he lives, and it's everything going on in his world is him and what he sees in the mirror and not listening to anyone else. This is a Gallup poll that's been going on for years, and it's shown that things haven't really changed that much. I don't have updated data on this, but essentially almost 50% of the population consistently thinks that the press is too liberal. So this is not a new phenomenon. This is not a new thing that's been going on with us. Super interesting graph here. So everybody remembers the Bowling Green massacre, right? The massacre that didn't happen.
The football game, I thought.
Yeah, not a football game massacre. Yeah.
Bowling Green got trashed.
1981. No. So Bowling Green was like this was a news phenomenon that was going on that had to do with a misstatement made by Kellyanne Conway that was repeated a couple of times, okay? So this poll, this data here, the question was actually whether or not Bowling Green shows that we need, that Trump's immigration ban is, sorry, I'm misstating the question. The question was whether or not the Bowling Green massacre shows that we have a need for Trump's immigration ban. Okay, so this was the percentage of people who agreed, disagreed with it. So the baseline, 57% of the people disagreed with that statement. 20% of the people weren't sure. And then there's 23% of the total population who agreed with it, right? But when we go to the category of people who voted for Donald Trump, 51% of the people, the majority of the people, thought that they didn't recognize that that wasn't a real thing. They thought that that was actual proof of a real-life policy in the real world. So this is going from a news phenomenon that was completely, it was widely spread that this was fake. I mean, that was all over everything. It wasn't like anyone actually thought it was real. And within a matter of weeks, the polling data is there that 51% of the people are just going to say, yeah, that's supporting it. What I think that's mostly probably just people that are going to want to, you know, in that category, those people want to agree with whatever Trump's doing anyway. And so whatever the primary part of that question, it might not matter as much. See, amongst people who voted for Hillary, it's 90% disagree. So huge difference there. But then when we start getting to the third party categories, it's a lot more mixed. Like people just aren't as sure. So
curious that the third party people just can't make up their mind.
Yeah, right? Yeah. They want kind of something.
Yeah, I don't know, something.
Yeah. Does anybody, who knows who this guy is?
Jumanji. Yeah, Jumanji.
Okay. He's not Jumanji.
He's in Jumanji.
He's the hunter from Jumanji. Okay. So I'm going to, for the kind of the last few minutes of my presentation here. He's not the dad.
He is the dad.
No, it's the same actor.
He is the dad. It's like
Peter Pan.
It's a different character,
Pan,
yeah. Though. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I feel like a lot of times in our conversations,
sometimes there's some symbolism in yeah. art.
Yeah.
This is one example.
Oh,
of
interesting.
That.
Yeah. Interesting. I never yeah. thought of that before. So a lot of times we can be like the hunter. So do you remember what the hunter did in the movie? Like he was just obsessed with get my gun, get my ammo, go shoot. Precision, taking people out. He wasn't focused on anything else. And sometimes when we get into these conversations, and like getting back to my point about what I do professionally, the things I see, you can feel like this, or you can identify with this kind of an attitude of just attack, be right, prove it, instead of anything else. So of course he goes to the store, gets his big gun. But the analogy that I want to make to Jumanji is once the board was opened, everybody who was in it just had to keep playing, right? Because it was a problem, and there's no way to turn it off. And that's kind of like it's kind of like the world we live in. So to the extent that we have a need to get out of our echo chambers, it's with problems. It's with world problems, things that, the environment, our health, what we do with our kids, how we treat people, criminal justice, those kinds of problems, we can't afford to be inside of our echo chambers. And sometimes we're the vulnerable one in the situation. We might not be the hunter who's trying to attack and persuade and move people. But if you remember the story, they didn't all want to play. Remember that? He had just come out of the game, so he was terrified with it, so he wanted to avoid everything. She had been in therapy for like 20 years and repressed all of this and didn't want to have anything to do with it. And then the kids had no idea what was going on. So maybe that's a little bit representative of how democracy works or doesn't work the case would be. But if we avoid the problem, if we don't do anything about it, if we disengage from each other, then elephants are going to be stampeding the square. We'll have rhinos tearing through our Victorian mansions. And I found this slide that just kind of had some representations of different areas of problems and different issues that we're looking at across the globe. And so getting just to wrap up my last point, the one thing I'm going to encourage people to do is go on your newsfeed preferences and find one contrary news source that's something credible, not, you know, don't go to InfoWars on there. And if you have InfoWars, take it off. But find a good source, even if it's Fox News or something like that, and put it on your newsfeed so at least you're seeing something else that's going on so that you're not completely saturated 100% in something else. It's easy to do on Facebook. So that's my kind of my reflections on echo chambers and my thoughts on it and a suggestion for maybe getting out a little bit more.
Well done.
All right. We could just stop and start asking questions, and then I don't have to do my piece if that's what we want to. Yes, questions? All right. My presentation is going to be in the form of a sacrament meeting talk. Felt a little bit like a sacrament meeting talk. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be playing two roles, the role of the narrator, which is the internal monologue, and the role of my, we'll call him Evil Matt. It's essentially a, my version of Erastus K. Knudsen. Stephen Erastus K. Knudsen, which is Glenn's
alter ego,
a person who is quite full of himself, so full of himself, he's humble about it. The typical person that aspires to leadership callings in these things. And in that, I'm going to try to make a point about echo chambers, I guess, okay? Try to identify the inner monologue and Matt's evil Matt. I'm going to do this. Okay. When Glenn asked me to speak about echo chambers, I was terribly terrified. I didn't know what I would say and really had no insight into the topic because I'm filled with echo chambers. That's all I know. I realized that sometimes the deity gives you topics in order to learn about yourself.
Yes, I do.
Yes. This is the narrator, the inner monologue. He says, feigning humility, knowing that what's about to come is a story where he's going to, in a self-aggrandizing way, demonstrate that he exemplifies exactly the opposite, that he knows full well that he's out of, that he understands the topic and is out of echo chambers. Back to Evil Matt. You know, I once was in an echo chamber. I was a very important attorney. I put people in jail. I thought I was a big deal. I was full of pride and self-righteousness at being able to punish wrongdoers for the wrongs they did. I was in an echo chamber. But I stopped doing that. I broke out of my echo chamber. I'm fortunate now to protect the rights of those accused. I'm effective. I'm just a street lawyer. I defend people. It's no big deal. It feels good not to be in an echo chamber anymore. Back to the narrator. He delivered that with chiasmus, demonstrating exactly how self-righteous he is, understanding the scriptural way to deliver a message. Now he's going to double down and throw an ultimate self-righteous gauntlet. Now that was going to be my talk, but something happened today, and the impression came to me that I should talk about something different rather than what I prepared. Now, that's actually true. now, although that's generally a way for me to come off as, I guess, why I'm not as prepared as I otherwise could be. That's kind of that move. But I'm actually going to be speaking as the narrator now because this is really kind of earnest. I was chopping down a tree today. Well, chopping down a sign at a tree, listening to a podcast about trees. And the thing that it was talking about really was related to echo chambers. Because as I was thinking about my own echo chambers and those things, I was thinking about that term and what it means. And Glenn gave a good example about not allowing other input. And I realized I'm certainly in an echo chamber, I guess, because I associate with those people who I tend to agree with. I certainly have... I look at the information from certain sources now, and I've determined that there's a certain process that I evaluate information from and draw conclusions in a certain way. So I've gotten to that point now at 42 years old, 41 almost. I'm not 42 yet, 41 in another two, at least for the next 2 weeks, where I think I've understood that. And as you know, the term is used as a pejorative, and again, referencing what Glenn was talking about is trying to be dismissive of people saying, you know, you aren't considering other information. And I don't think that's what's happening. What's happening, hopefully, is that other information is being considered, But a phrase that I like to use is that I will give it exactly the weight it deserves. And that weight may mean zero. But the fact that I give zero weight to something doesn't mean that I haven't considered it. And it doesn't mean that I'm not aware of it. It just means that, according to me, my own evaluation, that's not something I'm going to integrate into my life. So I was thinking about these echo chambers. I realized, well, something that I've been doing for the last year has been a very rudimentary personal exploration of mindfulness, meditation, and a form of, I'll just call it, Madism Buddhism, I guess, because it's a very personal, weird, my own thing. I really don't know anything about it other than what's coming in my head. And I was thinking about what my goal is in mindfulness is to develop an echo chamber of one, to get to a point where I can push everything else out, be in the moment, be present, focus on one breath at a time, and consider what my own mind thinks, what my own mind and my own self understands. And the more I've done that through meditation, I've developed my own echo chamber, but it's been an echo chamber of one. And I was thinking about this and listening to this podcast and about trees. They made a point about the body and how when we're internal and we're just in our own heads, we think, well, you're not really, you're not considering other concepts or extraneous or external stimuli, I guess. But inside the body, it's a fascinating thing. There is, now, I'm about to state a medical fact that I don't know if it's actually a fact because I listened to another podcast that delivered it. So, but what it said was that there are about 600,000 miles of blood vessels in your body, a transportation system of red blood cells. So in your body, there's transportation systems, there's communication systems, there's networks. So in being internal and in thinking about myself and this echo chamber of one, within my own body, I was thinking about this network of communication and transportation that's so vast and so broad and so effective that what I wanted to do through hopefully mindfulness and meditation is to turn that echo chamber into networks. And that I can take what I'm learning internally and try to extend and connect with other people in a symbiotic way. Just like these trees that we think are competing for resources, and that, you know, these larger trees in certain times are taking from these smaller trees. But what we've learned, as I understand, again through this one podcast that I listened to for about 10 minutes, is that when some trees have a need of carbon, they get it from other trees. There's a symbiotic relationship, this network that happens. And as I've traveled through my short life here, and as I continue to travel through life, I'm going to embrace those networks. I'm not going to call them echo chambers. I'm going to call them networks. And I'm going to find those relationships and ideas and concepts that are symbiotic, that enrich me when I need it, so that I can enrich them when they need it. And if people want to call that a bad thing, that's fine. Because as I do my ohms and if I find one breath, I'm okay with that. Because it's not because I haven't considered other things. It's because I've weighed it and maybe found it wanting. So I say embrace your echo chambers, but make sure that what they are actually networks, that they're symbiotic, and that you expand those in different forms and that you find the different places where a Venn diagram of networks can take place so that you can find these different networks that might be diverse and important in various aspects of your life. Because when I need Glenn and when I need this echo chamber and this network, I have specific reasons when I need him. Same is true with people outside of the infants, with other family members and friends, strangers. I have my networks, and those overlap in some cases, and sometimes they don't. And in each one of those instances, they can call those, I guess, a negative, that I'm isolated and insulated, and I'm okay with that. So, to steal something that Glenn was going to say, I'll now channel Gordon Gekko. Echo chambers are good. Echo chambers are great. That's my message.
I have a question.
We've only got a few minutes for Q&A, and so I want to get in line first. Because I want to ask Matt, this symbiotic network, and you gave the example of the trees that need carbon dioxide, so they get it from other trees. What happens when What happens when the symbiotic network starts giving you something other than what you're needing or what you're asking for? Because I think that's what happens with the response to echo chambers, where you expect, okay, I'm going to get my carbon dioxide from here, and then all of a sudden it's nitrous or something like that, and maybe the tree would say thank you, maybe it wouldn't. But what do you do in that case when you're not getting through your network what it is that you need or want from the network?
Well, I'm not sure if I understand your question, but what I heard from that is there are times when you may need to cut off things that are damaging and find other networks and find other connections. That's one one thing I would say on that. So I may be taking your question and turning it a little bit, taking your question and answering it the way I want to, I guess. But I don't know if that's directly responsive to the point that you were making about, you know, when somebody gives you something you don't want. That's one take. The other take is just what I said. If somebody introduces something that you're not expecting or not wanting, I say weigh it, evaluate it, and apply it in the sense that in the way that you determine is appropriate. And so again, my failure to follow or to be persuaded by your position or your opinion, you know, whether it be not pineapples, right, on a pizza, or whether it be a, you know, something that really matters to me and my people, I will weigh it, I will consider it, and my failure to follow it has nothing to do with whether or not you've been heard. It just means that I'll give it the weight that it deserves. That weight may be zero. Very preachy. Yeah.
Hi, this is Bob from Harriman, Utah. Infants on Thrones helped me progress from being a questioning Mormon to a doubting Mormon to a pissed off Mormon, and now I'm an ex-Mormon. So, good job, guys. Now, you can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. If you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Super easy to do. So, anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones. Infants on Thrones.